bacterium tuberculosis. Before we do, a couple announcements. First of all, on your worksheets from last week, I asked you to put the most probable pathogen. How many of you did that? Of the organisms you identified, which was the most probable pathogen? There may be one or two of you that did that. This week, I'll probably dock 10 points if you don't.
Holy
cow. That will get your attention.
And it comes to us.
Well, I have it in here.
So remember, this is not an exercise in futility, but this is a chance for you to learn. Hey. Speak.
So on every worksheet from now on, you want us to put the most likely pathogen.
Most likely pathogen. Okay. And sometimes there might be two of them. Maybe both of them are pathogens. But I want you to start learning what's normal flora and what's pathogenic. So that's why we're doing that. Okay. Also, some of you are getting a little lax in your report forms. You're not writing colony descriptions. You're not writing hemolysis and blood auger. So make sure. One of the points of doing these worksheets is to get you to pay attention to detail. Detail-oriented. So that's, again, what you have to do in the laboratory. So, and especially when Bill gets hold of you in blood bank. You're going to have to pay attention to details. So those things are important. They might seem minor, but those are important. When you do your CTA sugars, instead of just saying all were negative or all were positive, I don't know what sugars you did. So write down the sugars. Glucose, maltose, lactose. Okay? I don't know what you did if you just do that. And once again, I remind you to, when you do bacitracin, to do bacitracin and CAMP together at the same time on the same plate. Okay, we've got over and over and over and over that. Okay, here we go. Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Today we're just going to talk about the organisms in the genus Mycobacterium. Next week we'll talk about, I guess it's in 2 weeks, we'll talk about the disease state of tuberculosis. Okay, not all laboratories do Mycobacterium analysis. This is from the American Tuberculosis Society that lists 4 stages or extent of service. So one would be that the laboratory collects the specimen only, but they don't do anything else. Level 2 is they will do an acid fast stain or inoculate media only and then send everything else to a reference lab. 3, they will isolate and identify Mycobacterium tuberculosis only, and everything else they'll send away. And then 4, they will do definitive identification of all mycobacteria. So in order to get to level 4, you have to be a laboratory that does or sees a lot of specimens with requests for mycobacterial tuberculosis. So probably something like a VA laboratory or where they've got a lot of patients in there. So most labs are probably, according to the American Tuberculosis Society, either level 2 or level 3. Okay, now this is the College of American Pathology. They've just narrowed it down to 3 levels. And you don't have to memorize all this stuff. You just have to know that there are different levels and that you have to have sufficient volume of samples in order to be classified into level 3. So level 1, again, is just specimen collection only, no identification. Level 2, perform microscopy, isolate, and then sometimes identify susceptibility tests for mycobacterial tuberculosis. And then 3 is to do all testing. So again, most labs here would probably be level 2. So we don't spend a whole lot of time on mycobacterium in this class, and you probably won't do a lot of it at the hospital because of these different levels and the criteria that you have to meet to get there. Nevertheless, you need to know about mycobacteria because there are questions on registry exams about mycobacteria, so make sure you learn as much as you can, even though we don't really do them very much. There's a classification called the Runyon classification, and we're going to go through this later, so I'm not going to spend time on it right now. Let's first start with the general characteristics of mycobacteria. Okay, they are acid-fast organisms, which means we have to do a different stain. We have to do an acid-fast stain. And this is because in their cell wall, they have a specific lipid called mycolic acid. So 60% of their cell wall is composed of this lipid, mycolic acid. And for that reason, they don't take up the Gram stain because of all that lipid in there. So if they Gram stain at all, they're very, very faint. We call them Gram ghosts sometimes. So usually we have to do the acid fast stain. We'll go through how to do that. But they appear as long, narrow rods, red stain. So these are the acid fast organisms. The others are just other cells that might be in there that pick up the counter stain.
So it's pretty procedural to do a Gram stain, but what would clue you in? The doctor have to order an acid fast, or?
Well, usually the doc will tell you that we're looking for tuberculosis, or the diagnosis, clinical diagnosis will indicate that. So, because we have to put these on special media, they do not grow on regular routine media.
Okay, so the doctor would have to specify.
Right. They are aerobic, as opposed to the staphs and the streps, which are facultative aerobes. They are non-spore forming, non-modal, and most of them are slow growers, which means it often takes between 2 to 6 weeks for them to grow. What's generation time? What's the definition of a generation time? Time it takes to divide, one division, right. For mycobacteria, it's 15 to 20 hours, so almost a whole day. That's why they're such slow growers. What's the generation time for E. coli? About 20 minutes. Yeah. And that's why we use E. coli so much for laboratory analysis of different things, because it grows so fast, it multiplies and divides so quickly. So these are very slow. Some of them have pigment, some don't. We'll talk about that a little bit later, because that's an important criteria for identifying them. Okay, specimen type, sputum. So back to sputums. What we prefer is 3 specimens over 3 days. So usually 1 specimen is not adequate for mycobacterium analysis. So 3 specimens on 3 days. That means 1 specimen per day, not 3 specimens per day. And preferably a volume of 10 milliliters and a first morning specimen.
So 10 milliliters each or 10 milliliters?
If possible. We don't always get that, but if possible. And that's because of the way we have to process it, so we're going to explain that a little bit too. If a patient can't get a sputum, for example, if the patient is maybe an elderly patient, a senile patient, a non-ambulatory patient, or maybe a child, a very small child, sometimes we get that too, we can't get a good sputum sample, then we can use a gastric lavage.
Is the gastric lavage the one where you use water or saline?
Right. You put a tube down into the stomach and kind of flush it out with water and suck it back up and use that specimen. Problem with gastric lavage, though, and again, we want three samples over 3 days, is that the organism, if it gets into the stomach, it can die very rapidly. So this would be a patient that's probably swallowed the organism that's gotten into the stomach. But because of the acidity and everything in the stomach, the organism can die very quickly. So we don't often isolate it from gastric lavage, but sometimes we do. So it's an attempt to do it when we can't get it any other way.
And then, if it's so slow growing, what's the point of doing it over 3 days to get 3 samples? Would you expect to see much change between the samples?
Well, you might miss it. You might not get it. I guess the next one of the slides I will show says that these stains are only about 50% sensitive, which means we could miss half of them. So that's why we want 3 different samples. Give us a better chance of seeing it, because we might not see it in every single sample. If we see it in one sample, first sample, that's great. Then we don't have to have the others. A what?
A bronchial?
Usually a good gastric. Yeah. And we can do a urine sample. But again, this is very rare. Both of these are very rare. Because look at the urine. And only 2 to 3% of them are positive. But sometimes if a patient has tuberculosis, it can get into the urinary tract, and they can excrete it that way.
Yeah, how does that work exactly? I mean, like, cause I'm assuming it's down in the alveoli and whatnot, lower respiratory. So how do they get from there to the kidneys to the urine?
Probably swallow it first, and then it goes through the intestinal tract, maybe through the, what's that system? The vessel system that comes from the gastrointestinal tract that circulates around through the kidney. How you get bilirubin into the kidney. The same type thing. So, first morning sample, but again, very rare. I was watching a TV show a while back. I don't remember what it was. And they did a urine sample on a patient because they couldn't isolate mycobacterium and sputum, and they were...
House?
I'm sure it wasn't House. I hate that show.
I hate that show.
No, it was something before House, but it was pretty similar. The doc thought, aha, let's do a urine sample. And sure enough, they found mycobacterium tuberculosis. Question?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, how often do they do these things? Because I know for
very
tuberculosis,
rare.
It's x-ray.
Very well, that's the first thing is a chest x-ray. These are very rare. Sputums are quite common. In fact, we get sputum samples in the laboratory quite often, not only for TB, but for pneumonia and things like that. But the others are quite rare. Okay, so emphasize, the sputum is the specimen of choice then. Ooh, well, that mesmerize you.
And is there serological testing?
No, not that I know of. But there is...
The TB test, though.
That's a skin test. That's for the detection. Yeah, we'll talk about that when we get into tuberculosis in a couple of weeks. Okay, now this is different specimens, but this is for AIDS patients, so don't confuse this. We don't do these specimens for the routine run-of-the-mill patient with tuberculosis. This is for AIDS patients. Because they are immunocompromised, they oftentimes will get tuberculosis as a complication of their disorder. So there are different samples we can take, a genital, a fecal sample, and we often isolate Mycobacterium avium intracellularum. We'll talk about this a little bit. Tissue biopsy, spinal fluid. We can do spinal fluids even on regular patients, not AIDS patients, if there is evidence of meningitis, because occasionally, rarely, the organism can spread to the brain and cause tuberculous meningitis. In fact, I had an aunt that died when she was about 20. She worked at the VA hospital, so she was around a lot of patients with TB, and she picked it up, and it went to her brain and caused tuberculous meningitis, and she died from it. And blood samples. So again, most of these are for AIDS patients, not regular ones, except CSF, in which it's possible if they show evidence of meningitis. Okay, how do we process the sample then? Okay, this is processing. And I've abbreviated it DDC to make it a little easier for you to remember. Stands for digestion, decontamination, and concentration. Okay? Digestion, decontamination, concentration. Digestion, decontamination, concentration. What does DDD stand for? Okay, here's another acronym.
Need to know.
Need to know. Okay, so what we do is we take our specimen. Now, if it's a sterile specimen to begin with, like spinal fluid, shouldn't spinal fluid be sterile? Blood should be sterile. Okay, then we don't have to go through this process. We can inoculate it directly to our media, and we'll go through the media. But if it's a non-sterile specimen, which is what we most likely will get, like a sputum, most common one, then we have to go through digestion, decontamination, concentration. First thing we do is mix it with a reagent. Most common one is N-acetyl-L-cysteine, NALA. And what this does is liquefy the sputum, because we know sputums are kind of chunky and mucousy, and we want to break them up because the organism might be trapped in one of those chunks. So we liquefy it, break it up to release the organism. So that's what the digestion process is for, N-acetyl-L-cysteine. Then we decontaminate it. We usually use sodium hydroxide. There's a certain strength. You don't have to worry about that. Decontaminate there are a lot of other normal flora in a sputum sample. We've talked about that. As it comes through the respiratory tract, the upper respiratory tract, it gets contaminated. And these organisms are very fast growing, and so they can readily overgrow the mycobacteria. So the purpose of decontamination then with sodium hydroxide is to kill off normal respiratory flora and give the mycobacterium a chance to grow and divide. Because of their mycolic cell wall, they are more resistant to the sodium hydroxide, so we're not going to kill them as readily. Okay, and then we neutralize that. If we use sodium hydroxide, we probably neutralize it with a hydrochloric acid or something. And then we centrifuge. Okay, that's the concentration part. And we centrifuge at a high speed, 3,000, greater than 3,000, and the time factor is about 15 to 30 minutes. The reason we have to do it at a high speed and a greater time is because, again, these are, they have mycolic acid. They're fats, they're lipids. They float on the surface. So in order to get them to pack down into the sediment, we need to spin them faster and longer so that we can get them packed down into the sediment, because that's what we're going to use as the sediment. Okay? DDC. That's DDC. Okay, now once we get the sediment, then we can inoculate our media. We usually use a combination of solid and liquid medias. So let's continue on then with how we identify mycobacteria. Okay, gram stain, well, this is microscopy identification. So again, I put up gram stain to emphasize that we don't do gram stains because they stain poorly, if at all, due to the mycolic acids. What we need to do is the acid fast stain. Okay, here comes the acid fast stain. There are a couple ways to do an acid fast stain. Zeal-Nielsen is usually the standard, the one that was developed first, the one that's done most commonly, but there's a variation of that called the Kenyon. So what the Zeal-Nielsen is we stain them using carbofuxin, which is fuchsin with phenol in it. And then the counter stain is methylene blue malachite green. And we have to heat this. So we put this on a slide, and then we heat it over a Bunsen burner. And the heat drives the reagents through the mycolic acid cell wall into the organism. And then we get this picture again. So we end up with the red organisms. This is the malachite green, methylene blue counter stain that the other cells or whatever debris take up. So we used to call these red snappers. So you just look for that. Those red, long, thin rods. Okay, now the variation is the Kenyon. The Kenyon uses the same ingredients, except it's a little bit higher concentration of the carbofuxin. So we don't have to heat it, because with a higher concentration, it'll stain more readily. So no heat is needed. So labs will either do the Zeal-Nielsen or the Kenyon. Now, if it's a high-volume lab, where they do a lot of these, then it's probably worth them to invest the money to buy a fluorescent microscope setup and do a fluorescent stain, fluorochrome, using rhodamine-aramine dye. Because this one is very much more sensitive than either the Zeal-Nielsen or the Kenyon. And you don't have to, well, let me back up too. With the Zeal-Nielsen and the Kenyon, you usually have to examine your slide for maybe 15 minutes because oftentimes you don't see this many organisms. They're kind of sparsely populated. So you examine the slide for at least 15 minutes. With the fluorochrome, you don't have to do that. Just maybe 3 or 4 minutes. Because it's so much more sensitive, you can readily see the fluorescent organisms that are there. So it's worth it if you have a high-volume laboratory. Now, the sensitivity, as I said, is less than 50%. That applies to these other stains, not the fluorochrome. So you have to have at least 10 to the fourth organisms in the sample in order to detect organisms on the stain. And some people may not have that many organisms. The specificity, however, is very good. If you see these things, 99% chance that it is TB, but not entirely. It's not 100% specific because there are a couple other organisms that are acid fast. Nocardia is one of them. So TB, or mycobacterium, I should say, is not the only acid fast organism.
Is it
going
on? Most likely pathogen in from a sputum specimen, then, if it's acid fast.
Yes,
the other acid
most likely.
Are not.
Along with the other symptoms, the clinical symptoms, the X-ray, those types of things, you put the whole thing together to get the whole picture. But the laboratory is very important. Yes. These are for the acid fast, for the zeonilsin and the quinine. Not for the fluorochrome. Fluorochrome is more sensitive than that, but I don't have specific numbers. Okay, the media, we usually use a combination of media. And we don't, it depends on the lab as to what they're going to use. They don't have to use all of these, but they will usually use a non-selective egg-based media. It's called inspissated. Can you say that?
Inspissated.
That means solidified by heating. So the next time you have scrambled eggs, you can say you're having inspissated eggs. I ordered that.
Who wants inspissated?
Inspissated. I can see Bill cooking breakfast for his kids. We're having inspissated eggs. So solidified by heating, that's what it means. The most common one is Lowenstein-Jensen. That's been around for a long time. LJ media, the Lowenstein-Jensen. There are some others, Patrick Manny, and there is a formulation from the American Tuberculosis Society that is recommended too. But those are all egg-based. Then there's a non-selective auger-based media. And those are mostly Middlebrook media. So there are variations. That's why you get the different numbers, 7H10, 7H11. So we won't worry about everything that's in there. But it's auger-based, no egg. Okay, we can make it more selective using a Lowenstein-Jensen or even a Middlebrook with antibiotics, and that will tend to inhibit more of the normal flora and the faster-growing organisms. And then we usually they'll. This is the newest thing: is the BACTEC, which is a liquid-based. We'll inoculate some of the sediment into liquid-based. So we'll talk about the BACTEC in a minute here. Okay. For culture characteristics, we need increased CO2, so 5 to 10% CO2, usually at 35 to 37 degrees, unless the person has a mycobacterium infection on the skin somewhere, outer skin, and then the temperature is a little bit lower because of the skin temperature is a little bit lower. Growth rate, again, slow. I'm really having a hard time. Slow growers, which are greater than 1 week and oftentimes 3, 4 or more weeks. And then there's the other category, rapid growers. So there are a few that are in the rapid grower category, which will grow in 3 or 4 days, less than 1 week. Okay, we look for colony morphology. So usually check your media once every week. You don't have to scrutinize it every day because they are so slow growing. So you check it at least once a week. Hold it for at least 3 weeks before discarding it. We're calling it negative. We look for texture, shape, and pigmentation. So Mycobacterium tuberculosis is a slow grower. The texture is kind of rough colonies, rough surface. They're rough and dry, and they have a buff-colored appearance. Okay, here's Mycobacterium tuberculosis on Lowenstein-Jensen. Lowenstein-Jensen, the green color, both of these have a malachite green ingredient in there, which helps to suppress contaminants as well. That's why it's kind of this greenish color. But you can see the little colonies growing. This is a close-up look. Kind of look like cauliflower, doesn't it? Yeah. So rough-looking, buff-colored, no pigmentation to it. So that's in tuberculosis. Okay, now we do biochemicals. After that, after we get some growth, then we can do biochemicals. Now, we're not going to memorize all of these biochemicals. We're just going to go through the first three. The first three are MTK because they apply to bacterial tuberculosis. Okay, MTB is niacin positive, whereas most all the others are niacin negative. It reduces nitrate, so it's nitrate reduction positive, where most of the others are negative. And we do catalase. It's a little bit different catalase. I'll show you a picture here. MTB is catalase negative. We actually heat the sample in a tube, 68 degrees for 20 minutes, and this destroys the catalase, so it is not heat stable. So, what are we going to learn from this list? The first three, right. MPK, first three. Now, the others you need to recognize as tests that are done for the identification of mycobacteria, other species. Tween 80 hydrolysis, telluride, I'll show you some pictures, aryl sulfatase, and growth inhibition by this ingredient, TCH, which has a long, big name, I'm sure I can't say today. So just recognize these as additional tests, but these you need to know because that's how we identify MTB. Okay, here's, and they often do these in tubes with strips. So here's niacin positive. This is, nitrate reduction. Changes the color there on the strip. This is the way they do the catalase in tubes. So you can actually do a semi-quantitative catalase and measure the column of bubbles. But then if you were to keep this 68 degrees for 20 minutes for mycobacterium tuberculosis, it would destroy the catalase and you'd end up with a negative catalase. Okay, this is the tween 80, and again, just show you pictures to help you to remember a little bit better the names. Tween 80, tween is a soapy detergent-like substance. Telluride reduction. Where else did we see a telluride medium? Corybacterium diphtheriae, okay. Aryl sulfatase. This one splits a phenolphthalein indicator, so you get a pink color from phenolphthalein indicator. And then this one is the TCH. They use different concentrations and see if it will grow or inhibit it. It's kind of like a sensitivity, antibiotic sensitivity testing. Okay, there is a flow diagram for AcidFast. And again, all we need to know here is the characteristics for MTB. So first of all, we start out with AcidFast bacillus. It has to be a slow grower, so growth rate greater than 7 days. This is using Lowenstein Jensen. We look for pigment, buff colored. And I'm going to talk about before and after exposure to light. So both before and after exposure, it's still buff colored, no pigment. It's niacin positive. And nitrate positive, catalase negative. Okay, so what are the three characteristics of MTB? Niacin, nitrate, catalase. Okay, everybody awake? Here we go, we're moving into some important stuff now. Let's see where we are.
So, Sue, what about the rapid growers? Because then you say less than a week for them or
there are other species in here. This one is just for the slow growers, but there are other species in here. So there's probably different things to do for the rapid growers. Okay, now we have some new technology, and the reason is because in recent years, and we'll discuss this a little bit more when we get into the disease state, it is necessary to identify people who are exposed or infected with MTB. We have to identify them sooner than 6 or 8 weeks, because many of these people are AIDS patients, or they're transients, they're homeless people, and they wander around from place to place, and if we don't identify them sooner, they're going to be spreading this infection faster than they already spread them. So the CDC has said that laboratories that are in the business of identifying mycobacterium tuberculosis have to use methods where they can identify it within 21 days, 3 weeks. So we can't any longer just rely on the old standby methods that we've been using. So there's new technology. High-pressure liquid chromatography or gas liquid chromatography. What these do is it's a specific and rapid method that separates the long-chain mycolic acids. And so we can differentiate species a little bit better based on what type of mycolic acid they have. Okay, and here's the BACTEC method, the liquid method. This is what BACTEC looks like. It's this boxy thing that sits on the counter. And if you can see inside here, there are bottles, liquid bottles. They usually have some kind of a Middlebrook liquid broth base. And these bottles will travel around. They're on a conveyor belt. They travel around. And there's a probe that goes in. There's a rubber cap and a probe that goes into the cap and measures the airspace above the liquid. So, what's in the BACTEC bottles then, the Middlebrook broth base media, but there's also a radioactive fatty acid, carbon-14 palmitic acid, long-chain fatty acid. And the organism, as it grows in this, so what we do is we inoculate the sediment. We go through the BDC, the processing and all that stuff, inoculate the sediment into the broth, and then stick it in this BACTEC at the right temperature. And the organism will grow, and it will incorporate this radioactive carbon, this fatty acid, into its mycelic cell wall, and it will then give off, as a waste product, radioactive CO2. So the radioactive carbon ends up in the CO2 waste product. So when the probe comes in the bottle, what it is sampling is how much radioactive CO2 is in that airspace. And it automatically calculates a growth index. And when this growth index gets greater than 10, which is usually the cutoff limit, then you probably get a little buzzer, and the instrument is telling you this bottle has a higher growth rate. So we take that bottle out there and do further testing on it. So for the BACTEC, the average time to identification is 8 to 10 days, compared to a culture, which can take anywhere from 3 to 12 weeks. It's oftentimes around 6 weeks for Mycobacterium tuberculosis. So you can see how much time it saves. So that's what most labs will do now if they're really doing a high volume of Mycobacterium cultures, sputum cultures. Now, we can also use DNA probes. Remember, the DNA probes is a little section of the nucleotide bases on DNA, and they're complementary to a certain section of nucleotide bases in Mycobacterium tuberculosis. The probe technology is sensitive enough that we can apply it directly to the BACTEC bottle after it's reached the growth index level that's high enough to identify it as positive. We can apply the DNA probes directly to that without having to actually get a culture, a colony. Most of the times you have to get a colony and then apply the DNA probe to that. And of course, we can amplify with PCR. So these new methods then enable us to identify the organism within that time frame.
How fast is the probe and the PCR?
Probes usually take maybe 4 hours or so. So they're pretty quick once you get enough of the organism growing in the bottle. You've got to get that positive growth index before you apply the probes.
So the BACTEC is the most commonly used now?
In those places that are doing high volume, yeah, because of what the CDC has said.
How often is PCR used?
I don't know. I don't know how often that's used. Probably not extensively. If they get the growth index here, they can apply the probes without having to use PCR.
And so how long does it take to reach that growth index?
8 to 10 days.
Oh, see.
Average time to identification is 8 to 10 days. Now, the ideal futuristic test is to be able to get these DNA probes sensitive enough that they can apply these directly to the sputum sample and identify the mycobacterium that are right in the sputum sample immediately without having to go through all the other business. We can identify a lot quicker. So that's kind of where it's headed. And that's one good example of how these types of DNA techniques are coming into the laboratory. And the exciting thing is that it's going to be you people that do these techniques, not the MLT level, the technician level, two-year degree person. They'll be doing other things, but you'll be doing the DNA type stuff. Okay, a little bit about antibiotic sensitivity testing. We'll talk more about this when we talk about the disease state. These are the five main first-line drugs that are given. Usually when a person is first exposed to MTB, they'll get isoniazid, and we'll talk about treatment later. So these are the five main ones. There are some others, but the scary thing is, and I'm sure you've all heard about this, is the multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis. It's kind of like MRSA. It's resistant to these drugs and some of the others. And so if you get that one, in fact, there are some strains that are resistant to everything. So if you get that, You know, there's just no hope for that. So that's what we're trying to be able to do, is to identify these patients that have the disease sooner, treat them faster to prevent the spreading and to prevent the development of these multiple drug resistant strains. Okay, let's go through some the Runyon classification. So again, this is just a review of the characteristics of MTB. Minimal growth in 2 to 3 weeks. That's when you can first begin to see little colonies, and then it probably takes longer than that to get sufficient colonies to be able to do anything with biochemical-wise. Dry, rough, warty, buff-colored, and we've talked about the biochemicals. Okay, here's the Runyon classification. We'll look at these a little bit closer. There's the Mycobacterium tuberosis complex. And then there are anything else. We call these the MOT organisms. And MOT stands for Mycobacteria Other Than Tuberculosis. That's pretty clever. Okay, here's the Mycobacterium complex. These are strict pathogens. So it consists of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, which we know causes the disease state tuberculosis. There's M. bovis, which we don't see much in this country, but it's found in other countries. And this is the organism that they use to make the BCG vaccine. The vaccine is usually given in other countries, but we don't use it here. It's not that great a vaccine, and it will give you a false positive skin test. M. africanum is one, and then M. ulcerans, which causes Borrelia ulceration, which is a necrotic skin lesion that's mostly in African countries. So those are the strict pathogens. These are the MOT organisms. Okay, we'll classify them according to their pigment, photochromogens. Okay, these organisms are pigmented in the light. So we can do this one of two ways. We can inoculate two plates or two tubes, incubate one in the dark, and incubate one in the light, and see if it develops pigment. So in the dark, it will be non-pigmented. Or we can just inoculate the tube, keep it in the dark until we see growth, and when we get enough growth, we can take it out of the dark, put it in the light for 24 hours, and see if it develops pigment. So you can do that one of two ways. Okay, the one that I have emphasized is the only one that you need to know in each category. Okay, not going to worry about the others. M. kenzasii. So it causes chronic pulmonary disease. So it can cause a lung disease, pulmonary disease. It might be similar to tuberculosis in the initial symptoms, but it's not TB. Okay, so here's what M. kenzasii looks like. So in the dark, it's non-pigmented. In the light, and it usually develops this yellowish-orangish pigment. It's carotenoids that are in the organism that are released or developed somehow when upon exposure to light. Okay, then the next category is the scotochromogens. Pigmented in the dark. So we don't have to expose these to light. They develop pigment in the dark. I like to call them darkochromogens. But that's not official, so scotochromogens. Okay. Two here that you need to know, M. scrofulaceum. Can you say that? Scrofulaceum. Okay, remember, if you're going to walk the walk, you have to talk the talk. Okay, causes chronic pulmonary disease. And I emphasize this one, Vordinae, because there are some normal flora mycobacteria. This one can be found, we call it tap water mycobacteria. It can be found in water or in the environment, so it's not usually a pathogen. Rarely does it cause a disease, so normal flora. Okay, this is the scotochromogens. Then in the dark, they develop their yellowish-orangish pigment. Non-photochromogens, they are non-pigmented in the dark and the light. Here's our MAC complex, M. avium intracellulare. They're two different organisms, but they often go together, so we call them MAC complex. These are opportunistic pathogens, and these are the ones that we see quite frequently in AIDS patients. We also see Mycobacterium tuberculosis in AIDS patients, but we tend to see a lot of the M. avium intracellulare complex in AIDS patients, and they will cause chronic pulmonary disease.
What does MAC stand for?
Mycobacterium avium intracellular. It's both of these together. They often go together. The C stands for intracellular. I suppose I didn't put MAI because you can't say Mac. Okay, and here's the non-photochromogens, so you can see them going down here, lightly colored. So no pigment, light or dark. Okay, rapid growers. I've put two of them down here, M. fortuitum, which can be found in the environment, but it can also cause lung disease. And then M. chelinae, which is lung disease, chronic pulmonary disease. There's another normal flora, stigmatis. And it's possible that you could do an acid pass stain and see the red organisms, and they could be normal flora. So just because you see the red snappers does not automatically mean it's MTB or one of these pathogens. Now, the last thing I want to put down here is Mycobacterium leprae. This causes leprosy. And you know that that's a completely different clinical manifestation from tuberculosis. And we're not going to talk about that disease state, but the reason I put it here is because this organism is a mycobacterium. So it's closely related in terms of its characteristics to MTB, but it causes a completely different disease state. Okay, that's all we're talking about for mycobacterium, so in a couple weeks we'll do the disease state. So let's go to the lab. Hopefully you can all finish up today. Yeah?